listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara Byrne. Tonight, no good deed goes unpunished, the old saying goes. That could be the theme of Canadian thriller author Lynwood Barclay's latest called I'll Ruin You. The New York Times bestselling author is with me to talk about a page-turner that tackles some big and very timely topics. The lone two Canadian teams left in the fight for the Stanley Cup face off in Game 1 of their second round series as Vancouver hosts Edmonton on Wednesday night. The two Western teams actually haven't met in the playoffs since all the way back in 1992. And while fans of both have been trading some jabs online for several days now, we meet a couple who actually find themselves under one roof cheering against each other. How will they cope? They join me to tell me. On A Little More True Crime this month, clinical psychologist at University of Calgary law student Dr. Sasha Reed is the woman behind one of the most comprehensive serial killer databases ever compiled. We speak to her about her fascination with the topic and how her research has fostered better understanding of what motivates perpetrators, and how she and her team called the Midnight Order have also built a major database of missing and murdered Canadians dating back more than 200 years. We take you inside the Manhattan courtroom where former adult film actress Stormy Daniels was the center of attention today as she testified in former President Donald Trump's hush money trial, providing so much detail about their 2006 sexual encounter that the judge actually had to ask her to share less. So how important is her testimony to the case, and how was she perceived? We find out. But first, in the midst of a high-profile beef with LA-based rap star Kendrick Lamar, a security guard was shot and badly injured in front of megastar Drake's Toronto mansion overnight into Tuesday. Police have not named a motive or any suspects so far and won't say if it was related to that feud. Former Detective Dave Perry walks us through how the investigation will unfold. Let's start tonight in Toronto. So last night, we wrapped up the show with a look at this bitter feud between rap titans Drake and Kendrick Lamar. For those of you who might not be too familiar with either one of those names, Toronto-born and raised Drake was in Degrassi High 20 years ago or so. He's become the most successful Canadian music artist of all time, with 13 Billboard number one singles and a slew of number one albums. And he is embroiled in a bitter fight with Compton-born and raised Pulitzer Prize-winning rapper Kendrick Lamar. They were once collaborators more than a decade ago, but this simmering feud, or a feud that simmered for many years between the two, turned red hot last month. And the two have exchanged so-called diss tracks that have become increasingly more personal and insulting over the past several days. Last night on the show, we asked Billboard's Karl Lamar about just how bitter it had gotten.
I have never seen in hip-hop history this amount of damage done just from a lyrical standpoint. We have had over 10 diss tracks in less than a month.
Now, of course, the old saying goes, as Carl was putting it last night, as long as it stays on wax, everything is fine. Lamar even included an aerial picture, Kendrick Lamar, that is, not Carl, no relation, even included an aerial picture of Drake's mansion in New York, or in Toronto rather, in a recent diss track, the Video 4. Well, not long after my show wrapped up last night, and you can catch that interview, by the way, on our podcast at alittlemoreconversation.com. Not long after my show wrapped up last night, after that conversation wrapped up last night, there was an incident in front of Drake's multi-million dollar Toronto mansion. And that sent speculation and concern into absolute overdrive today. What police are describing as a member of Drake's security team, a security guard, who was standing in front of the gate of the home, was shot in the chest around 2 a.m. local time. It's not known if Drake was at home at the time or what the motive was. Inspector Paul Kravchuk of the Toronto Police Service's Integrated Gun and Gang Task Force provided some details earlier today.
When officers arrived, they located a male who was suffering from an apparent gunshot wound. That male was taken to hospital in serious condition. That person was working, apparently, as a security guard at the residence. He was standing outside of the gates in front of the residence when the shooting occurred.
Now, we don't have any details on the victim in all this. Apparently, he's still in hospital in serious condition. We don't have a description of the vehicle that was involved in this or any idea of a motive at this point. That being said, obviously, police were asked today about this ongoing feud with Kendrick Lamar. Here's what Inspector Kravchuk had to say.
Was Drake calm and is he cooperating with this investigation?
I cannot confirm if Drake was home at the time the incident occurred, but I can tell you that we are in contact with his team and they are cooperating.
To what extent is the rat beef between Drake and Kendrick Lamar part of this investigation's focus?
So, I am aware of what you're talking about, but it is so early in the investigation that we don't have a motive at this time.
There you have it. Well, some history here and why this is perhaps of concern, although we're not quite sure about the details or the exact reasons why this shooting took place. Most hip-hop battles remain lyrical. They're about being king of the mountain, right? But in the past, some have moved from rhyming to real violence, specifically the infamous 90s fight between East Coast and West Coast that saw both Tupac Shakur and Christopher Wallace, better known as the Notorious B.I.G., shot and killed in less than 6 months in late 1996 and early 1997. So there is some history here, and that may explain why there's been so much attention paid to this today, not to mention Drake is simply one of the biggest names in music. Forget Canadian music, world music right now. Joining me now with more on what the investigation may look like is Dave Perry. He's CEO of Investigative Solutions Network, Inc., a private investigator and former Toronto police detective. Dave, welcome back. Thank you.
Yeah, happy to join you again.
I'm trying to picture, you know, I spent time working as a reporter in Toronto. I'm trying to picture just how much this was being talked about in Toronto today, because it must have just hit the news headlines like a tidal wave.
Yeah, this has been the number one news story, of course, all day. I mean, shootings in Toronto, unfortunately, are becoming something not all that uncommon, but when it involves somebody like Drake or as a potential victim of the shooting happens right outside his $100 million mansion, it brings a whole new level to the story, of course.
Tell me, for the listeners who may not know, tell me a bit about the Bridal Path, because I think anyone who spent time in Toronto, I used to work at Global, which actually isn't that far from the Bridal Path in Toronto. Tell me a bit about the area, because that in itself is out of the ordinary.
Yeah, I mean, the Bridal Path is probably one of the most exclusive, if not the most exclusive areas in Toronto. There are multi-million dollar homes all along there, and not the area that's accustomed to this kind of violence and shootings and things like that. So you've just adds a whole new layer here. It's not just who, but it's where and when and everything else that's attached to it. It's a very prestigious, very wealthy area.
It was interesting to listen to police today, and it's not surprising to hear them say that they're going to treat this, despite the names involved, they're going to treat this like any other shooting.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the only approach. You know, what makes this, you know, such a high-profile case, of course, is the name. And it doesn't really change the whole investigative process. You've got to treat this just like any other shooting, other than, you know, again, who is involved. And you've just got to take it from point one. You look at, you know, potential theories and potential suspects and what's this all about. And of course, the whole Lamar issue can't be ignored. But who knows if that has anything to do with this whatsoever? It's a street investigation. It's a basic gang and gun investigation, and it's going to take a little bit of time to see if they can unravel it.
I suspect, given where it happened, there's probably a fair number of investigative leads they can pursue, including the fact that we have a victim in this shooting who has survived.
Yeah, for sure. And the unknown is always what did the victim see? You know, did the victim see, you know, his attacker? Was he able to get any kind of a description of the person or the people in the car? What kind of car it was? All of that. If there's any benefit, there potentially is some good footage of the vehicle in that area, because I'm pretty sure when I've been on that street, virtually every home has fairly sophisticated security system. So maybe they'll get lucky, but we've all seen way too many murder cases and shootings and other violent crimes in the city where you would think that something, you know, of use would be captured by video, but video is still video at nighttime, very grainy, fast moving vehicles don't get picked up real well. You got blurry images and things like that to go from. It's sometimes not all that helpful. So who knows what that search is going to net.
It strikes me, Dave, that this is a pretty brazen shooting, considering where it happened. I mean, again, perhaps at night the cameras aren't as effective as they usually are, but that is not an area without surveillance.
No, it's not. But, you know, people that commit these kinds of crimes, which quite often are associated to gangs, and this could be gang-related, that would be my educated guess, they don't care. They simply just don't care about the risks to themselves, the risk to the public, to the risk to anybody. They're just there and they're intent on doing whatever it is they want to do. And who knows what the motive was here. For example, could it have been a beef with somebody that somebody had with this particular security guard that had nothing to do with Drake at all? Mm-hmm. Who knows, right? We're just speculating.
Yeah.
Could it have something to do with Drake and it was, sending a message? Was it a gang initiation type offense? There's so many questions and so many unknowns at this time. It's just way too early to really have a good indication of which way this is going to go.
I suppose the timing of it is what has made it so, I mean, it would have been big news no matter what, but the timing of it has propelled it. I mean, I was watching news stories from the US about it today. I mean, this has become a huge, huge story. How does that impact the police's investigation, how they can do their job, considering how much scrutiny and attention there's going to be on this particular incident?
Yeah, for sure. The timing cannot be ignored. Of course, it has to become part of the investigation. You know, this very public feud that's been happening and the fact that they're writing songs about each other, not in a very pleasant way, that cannot be ignored, but it also could be just a horrible coincidence. But, obviously the police are going to have a very good look at this.
There's been a shooting in front of Drake's multimillion-dollar Toronto mansion that happened overnight. A security guard was shot in the chest standing out front of the gate of Drake's mansion and injured. He's in hospital tonight. The search for suspects continues. We haven't heard a description of the vehicle or anything about where the investigation is at just yet. Dave Perry is CEO of Investigative Solutions Network, and a former Toronto police detective. So, Dave, I imagine one of the concerns here, especially in this age of social media, is that feuds like this have a way of sort of spilling out into and other actors getting involved in this. I don't mean thespians. I mean like other people getting involved in this just based on sort of social media and all the way these things are different now than perhaps when I was in Toronto doing crime many years ago.
Yeah, for sure. Again, huge leap in speculation if we're thinking that this is connected in some way. Mm-hmm. To the feud between the two of them, but social media will definitely play into this whole scenario. But and I suppose in some ways even into the investigation, because there will be a social media component to the investigation as there is with most these days. But it's really going to come down to the police working the streets, working their sources, seeing what they can find out about that vehicle and the occupant or occupants of the vehicle. And just start right there at the ground roots and see if they can find out who and why somebody would come there and do that. Again, there's lots of theories and lots of things that potentially could be involved. And, it may obviously involve Drake and somebody's trying to send a message or get to him in some way. But also it could be somebody that just simply had a beef with somebody that works for Drake. So who knows where this has been ended up.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about, I've been to LA, obviously, and Vegas. And I mean, there's cities that are used to having a lot of very famous people around. And that comes with its own complexities when it comes to security quite generally, or policing, I would imagine. How is Toronto with that? Because I've always had the impression that Drake lives in Toronto and he kind of just, I mean, I'm sure he has lots of security, but he kind of just shows up at places like a normal Torontonian.
Yeah. I mean, the little that I know about him in terms of his personal security through sources that I have is that he doesn't really have the ability just to show up anywhere, just like any, major international celebrity. He has quite an entourage, and including quite a robust security team that goes with him everywhere that he goes. And like anybody that reaches his status, then we've done, a lot of investigations in support of celebrities throughout North America where, there's just so many people that target them for various reasons, whether it's stalking or harassing or whatever. So Drake is certainly no stranger to that kind of activity either.
Yeah. So where to from here then? What will you be looking for? I suppose, as you pointed out earlier, it really is just a basic investigation. Do the canvassing, talk to witnesses, find the video, talk to sources and so on. And we'll see where this, what could have been behind this.
Yeah, exactly. And, sometimes in those interviews, that's where you get the little gem that gives you the direction that you're going to need. But, I know what the police are really focused on probably in the first 24 hours is trying to find that vehicle and, find out who was in it and see if they can get a quick resolve on it. But it's, in spite of all the celebrity, it still comes down to a basic shooting investigation and one where we can't forget somebody was very seriously injured and is in very serious condition in the hospital right now. So it's a major investigation, and with every major investigation, there are resources applied to it. And specialists like the Gun and Game Task Force and others who will, do the best they can to find out who did this.
Dave, as always, thanks for your insight on this. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Anytime.
It was so damning inside of that courtroom. Many people could not believe what they were even hearing about a former president who was in the courtroom with his family and some campaign staff hearing about a sexual encounter.
Yeah, it was a stormy Tuesday in that Manhattan courtroom today. Jurors in Donald Trump's hush money trial appeared riveted as adult film star Stormy Daniels discussed what she says was a brief sexual encounter she had with the former U.S. president in 2006. As the third week of witness testimony in Trump's trial unfolds, Daniels took the stand this morning and told jurors the lead up to the meeting and that sexual encounter that she'd had and it engaged in. Of course, Trump denies the encounter ever took place.
She testified in graphic detail about having sex with Trump. And as she did, Trump nudging his lawyer, repeatedly urging her to intervene. And she did, strongly objecting again and again. Even Judge Mershon at one point calling the level of detail just unnecessary, later adding, there are some things that would have been better left unsaid.
Indeed. Well, the alleged sexual encounter and the $130,000 she was paid to keep silent about it during the 2016 presidential election are at the heart of the charges against the former president. Trump is accused, if you remember, of falsifying internal business records to cover up hush money payments, including the payment to Daniels, recording them instead as legal expenses. Trump has pleaded not guilty to 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. The case, of course, is the first ever criminal trial of a former U.S. president and the first of four prosecutions of Trump to reach a jury. But we knew Stormy Daniels would be there at some point, but certainly today it captured everyone's attention. The idea that you'd have Daniels sitting just a few feet from the former president recounting this story to the jury. It got a little more heated when she was cross-examined in the afternoon. She's actually back on the stand on Thursday. Tomorrow is a day off, as it has been all the way along. Wednesdays are not a day that this trial takes place. But I was really curious as to what it might be like to have been in that courtroom today as this was unfolding. Alex Woodward was there. He's the senior U.S. reporter for the UK Independent. He's been covering this trial from the get-go. He's been in that courtroom for much of the trial, and he was there again today. He joins me now from New York. Alex, thank you so much.
Hi, thank you so much for having me again.
Well, I guess just your initial reaction to what it was like today, because wow. I mean, just even the reports coming out, for listeners to remember, there are no cameras in the courtroom. And there are no recording devices. So we really rely on people who've been there. But what a day.
Yeah, it's been pretty stunning. We've been kept in the dark largely about who the witnesses are, or rather the order that they're going to be introduced. So we didn't know necessarily that Stormy Daniels, the adult film star who alleged having a sexual encounter with Trump about 18 years ago, we didn't know that she was necessarily going to be there today. But then it came out that she was. And suddenly we're thrust in this kind of remarkable circumstance of the likely Republican nominee for the president sitting feet away from her in a courtroom to describe that encounter that we now know he arranged tens of thousands of dollars to avoid ever having to deal with publicly.
Yeah, which he denies, of course. I mean, he denies the encounter, I should
right,
say.
Right, yeah, of course. I should, yes.
I mean, just to go back to why Stormy Daniels is so vital to this case, her testimony, a lot of, although the case doesn't directly, isn't only about this, a lot of that story is really, really crucial to the prosecution's case here.
Yeah, certainly. Of course, we're talking about a case that is about falsified business records, not about affairs or sex. Donald Trump is alleged to have worked with his attorney, Michael Cohen, to pay her $130,000 just weeks before the 2016 presidential election to ensure that she would be silent about her story of her encounter. Nothing illegal about that. NDAs happen all the time. However, what Manhattan prosecutors have alleged is that on the books for his business, in pay stubs, invoices, copies of ledgers, he marked down those payments that he was reimbursing Cohen for as legal expenses. Prosecutors are saying that no, what he actually was doing was covering up valuable information that voters should have known heading into the 2016 election.
What was the atmosphere like in the courtroom when she walked in? I mean, I think we've all seen pictures of Stormy Daniels, but there she is in that Manhattan courtroom sitting, as you put it, just feet from the former president.
Yeah, she arrived in all black, head to toe. She didn't necessarily glare at Trump, and Trump, you know, his son, Eric Trump, was sitting behind him. So he was also in the courtroom hearing details about this encounter from 2006. She was very kind of lighthearted at first. She was joking quite a bit, smiling, you know, laughing occasionally. This isn't a story that she's just told, you know, in secret. This is a story that she's, you know, now told several times in interviews and in her book that just came out. So it was kind of a familiar story, I think, for a lot of folks, but just the extraordinary circumstances of it all just made everyone kind of on the edge of their seat. There were a lot of members of the public in the room with me today watching, along with a bunch of reporters. And they were kind of, you know, laughing and chatting along. They had to be reminded to keep quiet occasionally by some of the court officers in the room. But everyone was pretty riveted. I mean, looking back and forth at how Stormy was looking on the stand, what was Trump doing at the same time?
Yeah, what was he doing? Because I can't imagine. Right. There was some stuff on social media today. I mean, all the reporting coming out, and you were there, suggests that he was none too pleased about what was being said to his face.
Right. I mean, again, this isn't a story that he's ever really wanted to be public. He's denied it. And he's, you know, also insulted her a lot on social media. So, you know, he's typically been sleepy, just zoning out. He said he's closed his eyes so that he could listen carefully. But, you know, these are sleepy proceedings. Typically, they go on for hours. It's a lot of lawyering back and forth. But in this case, you know, he was still kind of sunk in his chair, but he was nodding in disbelief, you know, shaking his head and, you know, mouthing a couple of times, maybe a couple of words, you know, out loud to his attorneys next to him. And then, you know, at points he was kind of squinting as if he was glaring, trying to believe what was happening in front of him or make sense of it.
Yeah. If we look into, because I gather there was a fair amount of detail here, lots of detail, as a matter of fact. I mean, if we look at the story itself that she's told, essentially she was hoping to get a break from Trump. That Trump was dangling an appearance on The Apprentice in front of her. And this is sort of what led to their ongoing relationship. And they wind up together in this hotel room. And then she goes into pretty graphic detail about everything that led up to that, and that night in particular, or that time in particular.
Yeah, that's right. So they had met at a celebrity golf tournament in Lake Tahoe, and that was in 2006. She said his bodyguard asked if she wanted to meet him later for dinner. Her initial thought that she told the court today was F no. And then she clarified no, that's with an expletive in front of it. But she ultimately agreed. You know, one of her associates had convinced her, you know, this will make a good story at least. You know, she thought, what could possibly go wrong? So then she walked us through, you know, that meeting where, you know, she brought us into the hotel room. She explained what it looked like, how long they talked, what they chatted about. But she was really angling for was an opportunity to get on The Apprentice. She knew that would be kind of a big career breakthrough for her. She was, you know, coming up in the adult film industry. She's, you know, directed a ton of films. She was writing these films. So she was, you know, she was on the up and up, and was kind of hoping for this kind of larger break. That obviously never happened. She never got that. But that's what she kept her relationship afloat for with him over the next couple of years. They didn't ever, you know, have sex, but she said, and then it just kind of fizzled out. But yeah, that initial meeting in 2006, she gave us so many details that the judge basically had to tell her to stop. It wasn't helpful to the prosecution to have so much prejudicial details about what had happened. The defense, at a break, while the jury wasn't present, had asked the judge for a mistrial based on the information that she was giving, that, you know, the jury, they were basically arguing that the jury can't walk away feeling like they, you know, that this can't influence what their decision is on charges that they argue have nothing to do with what she was talking about.
Was it that detailed? I mean, in that sense, I mean, it must have been awfully damning for the former president, the way it was being described by her, at least, which I gather from the reporting was pretty much what you might expect out of an encounter like that one.
Yeah, according to Stormy Daniels, when she arrived, he was wearing silk or satin pajamas. She told him to change. She did, or I'm sorry, he did.
Yeah.
She excused herself to go to the bathroom. She found, or she described what was in his toiletry case. It was Pert Plus shampoo, Old Spice, and gold tweezers. She spanked him at one point with a rolled up magazine. Just these kinds of details that are like obviously painting a wider picture of what the vibe was like in the room. But the judge was essentially agreeing with the defense, like, this is maybe unduly prejudicial and will, you know, maybe influence the jury in a way that shouldn't.
Yeah. Alex Woodward is the senior U.S. reporter for the UK Independent. He was inside the Manhattan courtroom today, where he's been since the beginning of the Trump hush money trial, to watch perhaps the most anticipated testimony of all. Stormy Daniels, the former adult film star, was on the stand today, testifying about her relationship with Donald Trump, including the alleged $130,000 payout to keep that relationship quiet. Now, Alex, obviously, I think it got pretty heated when his lawyers started what would be, I suppose, the cross-examination.
Yeah, definitely. So Judge Juan Merchan, he said, you know, I'm not going to give you this motion for a mistrial, but, you know, when you're up for cross-examination, that's going to be your opportunity to undermine her testimony. So they tried to do exactly that. We heard a testimony from Ms. Daniels at that point where she was, you know, really defending herself, that, you know, she was afraid that someone from Trump's camp would, you know, do something to her or her family if she came forward about this story. Felt like she had to hold Trump accountable and to commit to telling the truth. But, you know, Trump's defense attorneys had just basically painted her as an opportunist and an extortionist, casting her as trying to use a scandalous story from, you know, 20 years ago to smear a person that she admits she hates and to make money from doing it.
Having watched the trial up to now, knowing the story the way you do, what stood out to you then today? I know Stormy Daniels is back on the stand on Thursday. It's a day off tomorrow, but she's back on the stand on Thursday. But what stood out to you today? Because I think there's obviously a lot of attention around the spectacle of it, which you can, I'm happy to have you talk about more, but also just the, you know, what impact this will have on the case, period.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's interesting, you know, pairing this day of testimony against yesterday, because yesterday jurors got you know, a full day of what has, I guess by comparison, is relatively dry. This is a case about falsifying business records. So yesterday we got to see those allegedly falsified business records from top to bottom.
The crux of the case.
The crux of the case, exactly. So today, you know, we got to see how we got there through obviously very colorful, very like salacious and, you know, scandalous stuff that's been feeding tabloids now for years. So I guess jurors will be, you know, left to kind of connect the dots. Prosecutors said that they have maybe, you know, 2 weeks left of testimony left. So there's still a lot on the table. Again, we don't know the lineup necessarily for witness testimony, but There's two prominent gaps that I think a lot of people are waiting to hear from because they keep coming up over and over and over again in testimony, is Stormy Daniels, who we'll hear more from, and Michael Cohen, whose name has been on the lips of basically every witness who's testified, but who has yet to testify himself. So,
yeah. And then how is Trump holding up at all this? Because he's already in trouble with the judge. This clearly made him, enraged him today to have to sit there and listen to this. And he's already, again, he's been warned. I mean, do you get the sense that he's about to blow his top here, or already did today?
Yeah, I mean, he deleted a post on Truth Social this morning after he was very on the edge of lashing out at Stormy Daniels on there. So he is on the edge of violating the gag order again. Like you said, he's been warned many, many times now that he cannot speak out against witnesses, jurors, court staff, or their families. And yet he keeps pushing. There's still 2 weeks left of prosecution witness testimony. The defense will potentially present their case after that. And then there's closing arguments. So that's several weeks left of trial for Trump to potentially violate this gag order again. And he could be, you know, facing jail time if he does. So it's really a big test for Trump to see whether he can contain himself.
Just for you, what was your sense of Stormy Daniels as a witness?
She initially came off, you know, as extremely likable. She's funny. She, you know, went into detail about her background growing up in Baton Rouge, her hobbies and interests, her rough childhood, and, you know, how she came out of it. And, you know, she hasn't been shy about what she does. You know, she held her own against Trump's defense team. She didn't seem to budge when she was pressed against the narrative that they're presenting. So, yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell what a jury necessarily walks away with thinking about that. But there's a kind of buoyancy in how she presented herself. People, you know, can't walk away from thinking that that's boring or not interesting. So be curious to, you know, hear how the jury ends up thinking about it later.
Yeah. And just for you, I imagine having sat through more than a few trials over the years, this will be one for the grandkids, right? I mean, I watched Stormy Daniels testify at Donald Trump's trial. It's, if you would have told someone 10 years ago this day would come, it's still pretty amazing.
For sure. I mean, like I was saying in the beginning of this chat with you, that, you know, this is the man who could be the next president, and he's being forced to sit in a courtroom and stare at a woman that he is accused of covering up a sex scandal with. So that in itself is an extraordinary circumstance, and, you know, something that we're not going to likely see in any of Trump's potential criminal trials to come.
Well, Alex, never a dull moment. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
I grew up in the country. Across the road from me was this deep, dark forest. And right in front of me was this dark, murky lake. And it was fascinating to me, this idea that there might be monsters. As I started to develop, as I started to grow, I realized monsters kind of do exist, and they look just like you and I.
Thanks to the University of Calgary for that wonderful clip of Sasha Reed. What makes a serial killer? It's a question that has led to mountains of books, mountains of research, and countless hours of true crime documentaries, both audio and video. It is also a subject that has long fascinated Sasha as well. But instead of simply reading about the topic, which she did, like many of us do, She decided to tackle it. And so more than a decade ago, she started compiling what would become the most comprehensive serial killer databases, or one of them, in the world. It includes some 6,000 names, perhaps more now, dating back to the 15th century, and over 1,400 variables. Reed has taken a scientific approach to understanding what connects these killers and what we can learn from them. But it doesn't stop there. While working on her PhD in developmental psychology at the U of T, University of Toronto, an event in her life prompted her to begin a database on which she focuses not on the offenders, but on the murdered and the missing. And she does not do this alone. Indeed, her team is called the Midnight Order, and they are also the subject of a soon-to-be-released documentary about their work. All of it very fascinating, and she joins me now from Calgary. Dr. Sasha Reed, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's, you know, it's, I think a lot of us at a certain age, and you just described it so beautifully in that clip, have this fascination with fear in some ways, with what's out there. How did sort of a fear of what could be in the forest turn into a fascination with, you know, what you were describing as sometimes they look just like us?
Honestly, it's a weird and wild story. So for me, horror is my safe place. Horror is where I feel most comfortable. And I think that's because, one, I had a wild imagination. I still do, but I had a wild imagination growing up. And I had an incredible next door neighbor, Christopher Olenek. He was my very best friend at the time. And his mom would always let us come over and watch Nightmare on Elm Street and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And I feel like I connected those feelings and ideas of home and comfort with those scary, scary things. And then living across from the forest, you can't help but to think, oh, what exists there in the dark? So that's how it all started.
So how did it turn into that usual fascination? I mean, I think I read In Cold Blood when I was in my teens. I think I read a lot of those Joe McGinnis books like Fatal Vision and so on, about sort of true crime. But how did it turn from sort of something that you read about and enjoyed it, or were fascinated by, into this incredible project of developing this database?
Oh, Lord, that's a whole life story. But eventually what happened is, you know, I have wonderful parents, but they got divorced. And what happened is I ended up with step-parents who were not necessarily the best. It was not always safe being at home. It was not always comfortable being at home. And fortunately, at that point, you know, horror had become my safe place. But at the same time, it was kind of a bad thing because now I was living the horrors that I was watching on TV. And so I'd spend now a lot of time at the library reading books. And I came across Robert Hare's book on psychopaths. Mm-hmm. And that book got me to better understand the psychology of what I believed at that time to be what my step-parents were. And so that revelation of being able to understand that what's happening to me, what I'm going through, what I'm experiencing is something that I'm not alone in experiencing. And you know what? More than that, I know what this is. There's a reason for what's happening to me. And that why was such an extraordinary feeling for me. I just had so much more power now having a why that I wanted to make sure not only that I was able to continue understanding what was happening, but to make sure I could help other people get that chance to understand what had happened to them as well.
Right. How old are you at this point? Because sometimes with the timeline, I think, wow, you must have been not that old when you started all this work.
Oh, God, no. So I think when I came across Robert Hare's book, I was probably, 12, 13 years old. Right. And then the databases themselves, I was just trying to figure out the dates. I measure everything by which grad program I was in. So I started the serial homicide database in my very first grad program, which was a master's of child study and education and applied psych and human development. I believe that one was 2012. That's when I started that. And then missing murder database, I started in my second year of my PhD, which I think would have been 2016, 2017.
Right, which we'll talk about as well, because there was this first database that you worked on. Tell me a bit about how it grew and how you got the information, because it's really interesting about what it allowed you to learn about these individuals, right? I'll let you describe it, because you describe it better than I do, and some of the misconceptions that we have, but how did you build the database? Because it must have been, the information had to be collated somehow, right?
Absolutely. So is this the serial homicide database or the missing murder database?
The first one, yes. The one that ended up building off. The idea you built off later.
So the serial homicide database, how we built this out, this actually started as a psychopath database. I wanted to still, at that point, better understand how psychopaths develop. And in developing that database, I had several serial killers who also happened to be psychopaths. And so I'd finished a project on psychopathy and I thought, well, I have to build this database. I want to just focus now on serial killers, but I can't do this alone. I have some experience building databases and it is hard work. Mm-hmm. And so I figured, well, I'm going to have to put a team together. And so I did. And a team at that time, I think it was about maybe three or four of us. We started scouring the internet. We did deep archival searches, looking into newspapers, court documents, reading every single book imaginable, watching documentaries. At that point, podcasts were just becoming a thing, so we were listening to a couple things here and there. And then we got a little more sophisticated. We started, you know, understanding who was working with these offenders and reaching out via email or phone and just asking, is there any information you can share with us? And it's just continued, and not just continued, but evolved and exploded since that time.
Right. And the scope of it, too, I mean, you mentioned it, but it's become A, global, and B, historic.
Absolutely. So our oldest serial killer, I just checked before I started this interview, he is from 450 AD.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So, yeah, I think I said it went back a couple of hundred years. It actually goes back about 1,500 years at this point, more, 16.
Yeah. Like, to be fair, there's not a whole lot of information that we can adequately verify for an individual of you know, that historical record, but his name is in there, his crimes are in there. And so that's what we try to do with the database, is just be completely exhaustive in the information that we collect.
I suppose the obvious question is why beyond simply the sort of the archival the curious side of it, what has it allowed you to, because I gather in some senses it's taken on something, a different tenor in some ways. Why would you do it?
That's a very good question that I ask myself almost every week. It continues to be an exhaustive amount of work. I continue to do it because somebody has to do it. And to be fair, there's other scholars throughout, you know, the world who are doing the same type of work, building databases. However, I think what makes our database very unique is the fact that it comes from the perspective and background of a developmental psychologist, somebody who understands every single little developmental minutia and the way in which that impacts development, you know, across life, across time. And so I think that's really important. And I don't necessarily feel that it's been captured adequately in other databases. Other things look at, you know, I don't know, whether or not somebody was abused, what type of abuse, whether or not they dropped out of school. But there's so many other little details, micro developmental details that you can gather to help figure out more holistically who this person is and why. So one, I continue doing this work because I think it's valuable and important to make sure that we're having a complete and holistic understanding of these individuals, not only for the purpose of prevention, right, which is in and of itself a very, very difficult thing, but just in terms of being able to understand the why and to be able to give that to families who find themselves at the wrong end of a serial killer and who are asking, why did this happen? And even for the offenders themselves who do, we know, ask, why did I do this? They don't always have the best insight into, you know, how they became, what they became, or why they killed.
And Mr. Ridgeway, is it your desire to plead guilty to the 48 charges of aggravated murder in the first degree because you believe that you are guilty of each of those offenses?
Yes.
That is Gary Ridgeway, of course, better known as the Green River Killer. Dr. Sasha Reed is with us this hour on A Little More True Crime. She's a developmental psychologist and a law student at the University of Calgary. We're talking about a series of databases that she's built along with others as well. And we'll talk about the Midnight Order in a bit. But Sasha's also been talking a bit about how she came about to build this database of serial killers, which dates back now. I mean, it goes all the way back historically, more than 1,600 years at this point, includes many, many names. I think it's about 6,000 names at this point. Maybe not that many. Sorry, Sasha, if I got that number wrong. But I mean, practically
6,614.
Wow, that's a lot of names. I mean, we spoke a bit earlier about what some of the names we'd like to include, and I guess Gary Ridgeway was one of them. You know, there is a lot of fascination around the people who commit these crimes. I suppose in some senses you look at someone like Gary Ridgeway and he seemed oh so normal in court, right? I mean, that was part of it. We try to figure out why it is that people who look like that, who look like someone you could be sitting next to you at the restaurant, can commit such horrific crimes. You know, practically speaking, how has the database been used then over the years to try to better understand that?
So the database has been used primarily for the purpose of my dissertation, which was how do serial killers develop and why do they develop the way that they do? And at what point can we begin to identify where their development goes off track? So that was one major thing. But It's also been used to better understand the neurobiology of serial killers, to better understand the definitions of serial homicide. Are we defining it correctly? For what purpose are we defining it? It's been used to help overturn misconceptions about serial homicide, specifically the idea of the McDonald triad as an important developmental series or factors that link to this type of crime. So it's been used for that. And then also we use it alongside the missing murder database to kind of reverse engineer criminal profiles for the people, the offenders, and the crimes that we see popping up in the missing murder database.
Right. And that is actually, I know you've talked about this case a lot, but that actually was put to use in Toronto not long ago.
That surprised me. That was the very early stages of the development of the missing murder database. I'd already been kind of working pretty well with the serial homicide database at that point, but it was kind of incredible to see how well it worked. It was at that point in time just an experiment to see, you know, how close could I get in terms of creating an accurate profile, and it wasn't far off.
Yeah. Just a reminder about the case. I don't know where I was being cryptic about it, but it was the Bruce McDonald case. Did you work backwards from the victims and then sort of create the profile and then alert that there could be something happening here that looked familiar to you, given all your research?
Yeah. So that was the Bruce MacArthur case. And what had happened is I was looking at the missing murder database. At that point, I was inputting names and looking at the map and just seeing what kind of clusters I could identify. And in the map, in the MMD, I was able to identify several interesting clusters of people going missing in and around this one particular area. And, you know, we have a lot of that in the missing murder database. We have a lot of suspicious clusters. And it's not just enough to look at the clusters. You have to go deeper and look at the victims themselves. And so upon looking at each and every one of the victims, I thought, okay, well, the statistical probability of, you know, this happening to this particular population is very, very low. So I think we've got a good probability of a serial killer. And then I thought, well, I've got a pretty large database of serial killers. Let's see if I can identify what the profile would be on the basis of what I have in the database. And so I went to the serial homicide database and essentially just looked at serial killers who met the same type of factors, victimology factors, and came up with the profile I did. And typically, just for anyone who's, you know, listening, that is not necessarily how a profile is conducted.
No.
Yeah. But I it was a start of a project that has become much bigger. And at least for me, I think it's a really good start in terms of narrowing down a potential suspect pool. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just fascinating that the power of data, right? I mean, you know, when you have a database like that, it's the power of it, where you have all this information in front of you, and then how you are able to tap into it, right? I mean, it isn't a magic wand, but the information that sits in it can be very valuable. Tell me how you moved on then to creating, so you have this serial killer database that you still work on, and then you decide you're going to look away from the perpetrators and start looking at a much larger group of people, which is the missing and the murdered, right? And of course, these stories had come up quite dramatically. We remember very well during the Robert Picton case out west, the inquiries into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. This idea of needing a database like this, where did it come from for you?
Well, for me at the time, I was working so much on the serial homicide database, and it did become at a certain point a bit exhausting and also almost a bit boring just because it's the same thing day in and day out. And I needed a bit of a break. And in putting together the serial homicide database, obviously I'm coming across so many stories of missing and murdered individuals. And so I thought, I'll just look at these stories. I'll just look at the victims, and I'm not going to focus on the serial killers. I need almost like a palate cleanser. And so what I did then is I started looking into stories of missing and murdered individuals in and around my hometown, my area. And one of the very first stories I came across was an individual who I'd known in high school, and it was a moment because, wow. Yeah, for the entirety of, you know, the creation of the serial homicide database, I don't know the individuals who I've put in that database. I have no personal connection with them. But one of the first stories I read about a missing murdered woman in my area is somebody that I knew. And so that automatically started to shift my idea of, you know, everything that I was doing. And I had so many feelings about that. And again, at that time, for me, the best way I know how to deal with emotions is be very compartmentalized about it. And, you know, what do you do if you're trying to be compartmentalized? Well, you put something in a box. And so literally I put the name of my friend in a box in an Excel. It's just an Excel sheet. And for days and for weeks after, I started to include more information about her and then more information about other people like her, individuals who'd gone missing or been murdered and their cases were still unsolved. And it just grew. It became something that I worked on every single day. I still work on it every single day. First hour of every single day goes to the NMD. And I never stopped.
Wow. And I mean, was there anything out there, just to clarify, is it just Canadian names?
Yes. So the Missing Murder database only has to do with Canadian victims. Every once in a while, we'll have a victim who goes missing in Canada, and their remains are found in the United States. We'll keep them in the database, right? They start in Canada.
Wow. And it's grown. Was there nothing else out there like it? Is that my understanding?
Nothing. And I'm shocked. I'm shocked. I recently had several conversations with police departments across Canada, just talking about cold cases, not really about databases, but of course the conversation gravitates. And I found that so many departments are looking for good data. They're looking to build databases. Some departments are in the midst of discussions about how do we build a database, but still the issue is they remain jurisdictional. Right. So mostly people are talking about how do we create a provincial database? And that's all well and good, with the exception of the fact that offenders cross borders. And when they do, you're not then going to be able to capture them. Now, we do in Canada, I got this wrong yesterday, I said the wrong word, but I'm going to get it right today. We have VICLAS, which is essentially a national database looking into similar types of things, or looking into crimes and trying to connect the dots and find patterns. But there are several issues with that, and the issues have to do with it's super boring, like, for anybody except for me and other nerds, but inter-rater reliability. So, you know, the data that's being input, it's not always correct. And then also, it's not always mandatory. And so you have these massive gaps in data. But with the missing murder database, we're completely exhaustive. Our inter-rater reliability is 85%. So I'm pretty happy with the work that we do. And it just, nothing like it exists.
Yeah. How far back do you go? It's Canada-wide. And how far back does it go?
Our oldest case is 1805.
Oh, wow. How did you compile it? Because again, jurisdictional issues are one challenge. Just gathering the information must have been another one.
It is a headache every day. So it's the same with the serial homicide database. We started using the same methodology that we did, except we kind of just looked, we started by looking at Canada first, right? Canada missing persons, Canada cold cases. And then we started going smaller. British Columbia cold cases, British Columbia missing persons. And then we went smaller than that, looking at municipalities or cities, towns, until we completely exhausted our search. After that, we just continued doing broad searches. We looked at newspaper archives, court records. We've had conversations with police departments, which have been sometimes good, sometimes not. We go into communities and we talk to people and we get more information from them. Sometimes we have family members reach out to us. They'll just email us and send us information about their missing or murdered loved one and want to make sure that it's in the database. So we try to be as completely exhaustive as we can be. It's hard.
I should ask you about this now, because you use the we a lot as opposed to the I, and I know there's a whole team with you that you're very proud of. Tell me a bit about them.
The Midnight Order. Oh, my goodness. This is the most exceptional team I have ever worked with. So this is a team of individuals who are from a very diverse series of backgrounds. So we've got doctors, we've got lawyers, psychotherapists, we have police in training and more. And some of these people have been with me since 2016 and continue to do this work. And they're motivated for the right reasons, right? Wanting to find answers for families who are suffering and struggling. wanting to better understand the minds of offenders so that we can create preventative programming and systemic changes to help communities. Yeah. So,
although many of the missing and murdered women had strong and close relationships, were loved by their families, friends within the downtown Eastside community, their marginalized status resulted in the women as individuals and as a group by many people as being nobodies.
That was Wally Opal many years ago now, but more than a decade ago now, Commissioner of BC's Missing Women's Inquiry that was launched in the wake of the horrific revelations in the Robert Picton investigation. Dr. Sasha Reed is with us this hour on A Little More True Crime. She's a developmental psychologist and a law student at the University of Calgary. She has, along with others, developed two major databases, one about serial killers and another about missing and murdered Canadians, some 12,000 of them. Sasha, obviously in this case, there are groups out there who very much would like your help and would like the information that you've gathered to help them. Because I think when we listen to Wally Opal talk about that, I know you've been involved to some extent with the Picton families, although I know there's only so much you can talk about. But clearly it offers an example of how the database can come to good use practically.
So practically, the missing murder database, to understand the way that this can be used, you need to understand the level of data that's there. We are able to identify not only suspicious clusters of missing murdered individuals, but we're able to identify through that systemic issues, structural problems that exist within communities, within provinces. So, for example, when we're seeing clusters of missing murdered people, we might think immediately serial killer, but you'd be wrong to do that. You want to look at the victims. And so in looking at the victimology, we've been able to see, okay, well, actually there's problems here because there's no Wi-Fi in this area. There is no adequate transportation in this area. People are relying, for example, on hitchhiking, and that increases risk. And so one of the ways that we're using the MMD is to be able to, one, help people identify that there are suspicious clusters of missing and murdered individuals. Two, identify structural issues that might be leading to increased risks of harm. We can identify body disposal sites. We can identify when potentially police investigations have not been completely conducted or thoroughly conducted. And at the very, very least, it's a place to ensure that the lives and the names of those who are missing and murdered are remembered.
How have the police reacted to this?
Mixed reactions. So I know when the Bruce MacArthur story broke, the Toronto Police Service was wonderful. They reached out right away, and we had many good, very constructive conversations about the database, about the case. They were really helpful in identifying a few names that hadn't been in there already, so that was good. And in Edmonton Police Service was a little bit different, not so constructive, but it is what it is. Ontario Provincial Police, they were fantastic, wanted to learn a little bit more about the database just because they, I guess, hoped to form their own. And so that was a really constructive conversation. It's not necessarily police forces that we're looking to work with, though, or partner with. In building this database, we've come to learn about so many issues that affect people and communities. And for us, I think it's really important that communities always have a really strong say in, you know, what goes on with the research in their communities and how people are interacting with people in their communities. And so first and foremost, we utilize these databases with communities who have a long-standing commitment to helping protect the lives of people in those communities. So we're looking to work with people who are actively on the ground, already doing that work from a grassroots perspective, and it's been quite fruitful.
Yeah, tell me about that. Without, again, I know there are issues you can't talk about fully, but how has it worked on the ground, for example?
On the ground, in terms of policy changes. So, for example, I won't say too much, but we do have meetings on a monthly basis where there's discussions about, you know, the violence that some communities are undergoing and, you know, the role of data, big data, and how can we create better data to help support these communities. Those discussions have now become policy pieces, and this is not just me, this is an entire collective of people, but this has become a much bigger discussion where there are now bigger, broader policy implications of the work in this database that are going to be used. We've also used it to help support communities who are in the midst of activism, trying to support MMIWG issues, providing them with images and statistics just to help push and propel their issues forward. You know, sometimes you hear all of these stories, you hear individual stories, and normally that's enough, right? But there are some communities for whom, unfortunately, that just doesn't seem to be the case. And when you're presented with statistics to help support the fact that this is a big issue, this is an ongoing issue, this is not stopping, I think it helps a lot. So that's a couple of the things that we do.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me that for so long, part of the issue was that it was information. It was information sharing. I mean, if we go back to the 70s and the 80s, so many things happened because, you know, jurisdictions weren't talking to each other or didn't know what was happening in other jurisdictions before sort of the advent of technology. And then we moved in to the Picton years and you know, that horrific case. And that was about sort of the invisible, right? People and you know, Gary Ridgway was the same, targeting the vulnerable and how people would go missing and no one would know, right? And then if you build this large database, you have the information. And then what you do with it, that's the next step. But having the information, period, all in one place has a sort of infinite possibilities.
It does. It does have infinite possibilities, which is why I say it's not enough to make a provincial database. You do need a very high quality national database, because you see things that you would never have imagined that you'd be able to see through this lens.
How would you describe your work then? Because it does stand out there. I remember talking to one of the lawyers working with the families of Robert Picton's victims, and she mentioned you, and she had trouble describing precisely what it is that you did. She just said you really need to talk to her. And it was interesting because it does kind of it is kind of indescribable, the kind of work you've been doing, right? I mean, it's unique.
Yep. That must have been the brilliant Sue Brown from Justice for Girls.
Indeed it was. Yes, it was.
Wonderful. So I think she has difficulty describing what I do, because I also have difficulty describing what it is exactly
indeed.
That I do.
Right.
I'm a developmental psychologist who studies serial killers, who builds databases, and who identifies patterned crimes, goes into communities and tries to help those in need, while also being a law student and filming a documentary.
Great to have Dr. Sasha Reed with us this hour on A Little More True Crime, talking about her work and all its different variables. She's a developmental psychologist and law student. Sasha, it's been interesting about this documentary that I keep reading about, because I know you don't want to get too much into it, but interesting that a very well-known documentary maker, Nancy Schwartzman, has turned her eyes on you and your work and The Midnight Order, all the others that you've worked with as well. That's quite the honor.
It is the honor. We've been working together now for a very long time, and it's been a roller coaster. It's been incredible.
Tell me a bit about just the work that you do and how you think it fits in. You know, I think you were interviewed by a guy named John Allure a while back, I think in 2018, and we had him on the show actually last year, and he passed, right? He was killed in a cycling accident, sadly. And what really impressed me about John is that he was one of those people who, he had many other things on the go, but he was such a devoted person to try to raise awareness about what he cared about. His sister had been murdered many years ago in not far from where I grew up, actually, outside of Montreal in Sherbrooke, in Lennoxville, actually. And it just reminded me that there is room out there for people to do different things to advance this notion of both crime fighting and solving and making the world a slightly better and slightly safer place.
Yeah. So first, I just wanted to say John Allure was a very good friend. I actually did not realize his passing until just a couple months ago, and it hit pretty hard. John Allure was a hero and an idol, I think, for some people in the true crime community. I know when I first started out, he was the very first person to reach out to me after the Chris MacArthur story. And he put me on his podcast. And of course, you know, very first podcast I'd ever been on, it was very awkward, but he was filled with kind words and made me feel that much more confident doing what I did. And I'm so grateful for the work that he's done. It's extraordinary. And of course, he's going to be very missed. But again, He made me feel like you could do it. You didn't have to be a detective or a police officer or in an official capacity to do this work. And I think the more I work on it, the more I realize there is a necessity. There's not just space for people like us. There's a necessity for people like us. And the reason for that is we have so many unsolved cases of missing and murdered individuals that there is just no realistic probability of police forces with the resources that they have at the moment going and solving those cases. Most police departments don't have cold case units. And so there's a gap. There's a massive gap. And so I think the work that we do at the Midnight Order is work outside that system, right? Outside a traditional investigative system to do what has to be done. Look into cases. Sometimes all we do is just hear the victims and have their stories validated. This happened to you. We'll take that time. There's absolutely a need for people who do this work, do it ethically, and do it effectively.
How do people contact you? I mean, if anyone listening wanted to contact you or look at the database, is that possible, or how do they contact you?
So to contact me, you just have to email midnightordermmd@gmail.com. That's a direct link to me, so I'd be very happy to email you if you send me an email at that address. The database itself is currently not publicly available, and the reason for that is multifaceted. One, there's a documentary. Two, we're working with communities and organizations right now to figure out how do we best make this public in a way that does little, if any, harm. We don't want harm to come out of this. And it is at such a point right now that it's quite an extraordinary amount of data. So we would just want to make sure it's in the right hands, in good hands, in ethical hands. And so that conversation is currently happening. There was an article published a couple months ago by Lori Culbert and the Vancouver Sun that posted a little bit of information that we had from British Columbia. So you're welcome to look at that. And there's some bits of the database there. But stay in touch. I mean, I have Instagram, TikTok, you name it. I've got a social media platform, usually at the Midnight Order. And we update those every once in a while and just talk about the work that we're doing, what we're up to, and all of that.
Where do you take this from here? I mean, you're in law school, right? To top this all off, you're now in law school. So I gather at some point you'll become a lawyer. So you wanted to bring that perspective into it as well. It's been interesting just to watch the evolution of what you've done, because it seems like each time you think, oh, I should really know more about that, you go off and study it as you're doing now.
I have to stop that. It's a very bad habit.
Some people do it for a lifetime, Sasha. Some people do it for a lifetime.
If I didn't have a husband, I think I would probably go into medical school next. But, you know, I have a husband, right. So now I can't, no med school. But for me, I'm actually finished law school. I graduate officially in June, but school's out. I article with Legal Aid for the next year. That's incredible. I'm very excited about that. But in the meantime, I'm going to continue researching and studying serial killers, how they develop and why. Putting out literature, making sure that people better understand these offenders, looking into the database and trying to better understand the context of missing and murdered people in Canada, and trying to create strong collaborations and networks so that we can work outside the traditional system to help solve these cases and put in policies and practices that can better protect communities.
Well, Sasha? Dr. Sasha Reed, I really appreciate your time tonight. It's been fascinating to find out more about what you do, because it is one of those things that takes a while just to walk all the way through it, because there's so much there. But congratulations on all your work. Congratulations on graduating from law school as well. And I look forward to talking again.
Thank you so much for having me. And please, everyone, feel free to email me, midnightordermmd@gmail.com.
There you have it. And we look forward to the documentary. Do you know when that's out officially?
The documentary is called Sasha Reed and the Midnight Order, and it will be out this year, I believe this summer. I don't have an official date yet, unfortunately, but it will be out very soon. On Disney Freeform.
Right. I think it's on IMDb already. You can sort of see the title, but there's no release date. Sasha, thank you so much.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Have a great night.
Oh my gosh, amazing, crazy, honestly, like, I can't even speak. That's what it is. We won, everybody!
Yeah! Amazing, man, this is amazing. This city is lit. We're gonna go all the way to the end. I know it! Let's go!
Vancouver, where are you at?
We want Vancouver! Listen, if I were McDavid, man, I wouldn't even put the skates on. It's going to be a long day for him.
There you have it. Edmonton fans to begin with, and Vancouver fans after that. You can't really tell the difference at this time of year. When you win your first round series, everyone goes a little overboard, right? You know, it's been more than 30 years since Edmonton and Vancouver met in the playoffs. I mean, these are two, there's a lot of Albertans in BC, and of course, there's a lot of connections between the two. It's not a long flight, right, between the two cities. There's a lot of back and forth. I think we interviewed someone not long ago who actually lives in Edmonton and works in Vancouver. So yeah, there you have it. That's how close they are. You'd have to go all the way back to 1992. You know, the Prime Minister was Brian Mulroney. Alberta's Premier was Don Geddie. Mike Harcourt was BC's Premier. As Craig Baird pointed out on his history, Canadian History X Twitter feed, Canada's population was just 28 million people, and the Blue Jays had won their first back-to-back World Series. The Oilers won that series, by the way, back in 92 in six games. Joe Murphy led the way for Edmonton. Jeff Courtnell for the Canucks. You can tell just how it's like a different era, right? Edmonton swept the Canucks in their only other playoff meeting in 1986, so they're 7-2 going in. But there's not a lot of playoff history between these two teams. That's all about to change tomorrow night, as you can tell from their reaction. Both the team's fans are hyped about this and have a pretty good idea that their team, I mean, the way it's worked is that Vancouver won the season series. I think they won all four games. But Edmonton had a really bad beginning of the year, so they played much better since. So we basically have two teams colliding at a pretty perfect time. Fans in both cities, as you can tell, I've been throwing jabs. There's a bet between the premiers, David Eby and Danielle Smith. All of it is happening, and it feels like there are two separate camps, but not for my next guest, because their two separate camps happen to be under one roof. Derek and Kristen Slavin are a couple in BC, and they cheer for different teams. Derek cheers for the Canucks. Kristen cheers for the Oilers, and they join me now. Thank you both for your time tonight.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
Kristen, I guess we'll start with you. Are you a lifelong Oilers fan? Has this been it? Have you been orange and blue from the get-go?
Yes, I grew up in Edmonton.
Yeah, indeed. And Derek, same with the Canucks?
I was taken home from the hospital in a Canucks jersey. So, yes.
So did this come up early on in your dating? Did you sort of say, hey, what about, do you watch much hockey? Was this a topic of conversation?
This was definitely top of conversation when we first started.
Kristen, what did you say? What did you think?
Our first date was a Canucks game.
Did you not cheer? Did you sit in your seat when they scored? Or?
If the Oilers aren't there, then they're the backup team.
Right. So there's that. I'm glad you have that arrangement. So as these playoff series began, Derek, I guess we knew perhaps that if in fact both teams were to win their series, that they were going to meet in the next round. Did you anticipate this coming?
Yeah, we were starting this conversation right from game one. Watching the Canucks in Nashville and Oilers in LA, and we're like, oh, could you imagine if this came to fruition? If we actually got to see each other in the playoffs, the conversation was had. We were already starting to plan bets. It's been a topic of conversation for the last few weeks.
And Kristen, what kind of bets are we talking here? Like, what is a friendly wager between a married couple?
I don't know, man. We're still trying to decide.
She wants to make it something embarrassing.
Really?
Yeah.
Such as, without, if you can.
I don't know. Something standing on a street corner or something with a sign or a jersey.
And Derek, are you thinking of something maybe a little less humiliating if the other team?
Oh, absolutely not. I'm going full tilt.
Okay. So what does your bet look like?
I'm thinking probably wearing a Canucks jersey, chanting something to do with the Canucks, and then I'm going to probably stream it somewhere where Oilers Nation can see it.
Wow. So do you both own the other person's jersey? Kristen, do you have a Canucks jersey that fits you?
I do have a Canucks jersey.
Okay.
But Derek gave it to me. So
of course he did for Christmas. And Derek, do you have an Oilers jersey?
The only hockey jerseys I have ever owned are Canucks jerseys.
Wow. So here's something. I mean, I grew up in the 70s and the 80s, and of course the Oilers were a powerhouse. I always liked the Canucks. Actually, the first game I ever saw at the Montreal Forum, second game I ever saw at the Montreal Forum was the Canucks and the Canadiens. And I liked their stick shirts, and I thought they were cool. But, I mean, you would have had to – I mean, the Oilers have won a lot of cups, and, you know, I mean, I was born in 1970, so the Canucks are as old as I am and still looking for cup number one. Kristen, do you feel any sympathy for Canucks fans that maybe this could be their year and maybe it should be okay to sort of say, you know what, you have your cup, honey?
I have sympathy that they're going to go out in this round, but that's about it.
And Derek, same?
This is not going to be an easy series. I'm a realist. It's not going to be an easy series. I'm not going to say that, it's going to go one way or the other. I think this is going to go to seven games. That's my final answer.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I mean, both teams look good in the first round. What's it been like just for the cup drought? Because when I think of the Canucks, I remember watching, I was living in Beijing actually with a bunch of kids from Vancouver. We watched the Canucks lose game seven to the Bruins in 2011. Of course, I remember the Rangers series, obviously. I mean, it's been a tough go. I mean, you've waited a long time as a Canucks fan to hoist that cup.
You know what? As a true sports fan, you go through ups, you go through downs, you live through disappointment, but you stick with your team. I've got a lot of friends who've grown up here who are now Oilers fans because it's the next province over and the Calgary Flames suck. So, you know, there's...
We can agree on that.
Yeah, that's one thing we can agree on. I've had a lot of friends who have crossed over to the dark side. I'm not one of them. There has been a lot of disappointment. I was 13 years old in 94 when the Canucks went against the Rangers, and mm-hmm. I can remember skating up and down one of the main roads on my rollerblades with my friends and holding big fake tinfoil Stanley Cups. And, you know, like those were some of the best memories of my life. And then the 2011 Stanley Cup run was just, it was an absolute heartbreaker because we all thought that was our season, that was our year, and Brad Marchand had to come and ruin that.
Indeed, he's ruined others as well. And more recently, Kristen, it's funny that Calgary came up because I think David Eby tweeted about this, the Premier of BC, and he also mentioned that to Danielle Smith that, you know, we could share our distaste for Calgary. I suppose that you could actually agree upon. You don't like neither of you like the Flames.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
So, Kristen, tell me a bit about what you have planned then for this series. Do you sort of sit there and do you go to separate parts of the house and sort of put on your stuff and then meet in neutral territory down to watch the game?
Well, we usually watch the games together, but I am actually taking our son to Edmonton so that we can live a bit of that playoff magic there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Jacob is his name, right? Is that right? Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Derek, does he have a Canucks jersey or does he have an Oilers jersey? How old is he, I should ask?
He has both. Unfortunately, okay. The last couple seasons, he's been donning his Oilers jersey a little bit more frequently. Wow. But definitely this season, he's grown into his Canucks jersey finally. So he has been wearing it more often. I'm hoping he's going to wear this past this round.
Yeah, you'll have to get him one of those ones where you sew the jersey, sort of cut it, cut it in half and sew it together so he can wear both and walk around the house so he can be the neutral. What's he make of all of this then? Because he must know that you cheer for different teams.
Yeah, he sure knows. He cheers up and down and he'll scream with us when I'm jumping up and down after, you know, when the Canucks finished off Nashville. I scream pretty loud and he joined right in and wound up, I think he actually slipped and bonked his head and cried a bit. But he definitely knows how to cheer with whoever's cheering at that moment.
Right.
Yeah, he gets to cheer all the time. So it's great for him.
Right. I guess at that age. Yeah. So Kristen, you're actually bringing him back to Edmonton and leaving Derek all by himself to watch game one?
Game two.
Game two, okay.
Right. Yeah, we're gonna watch game one together, and then she's taking her son and flying off to see family in Edmonton for a week, and so she'll watch the rest of the games from Edmonton.
You should watch the rest of the Vancouver suite.
They're going to be done in four.
So do you taunt? Yeah, do you taunt each other a lot? Like, Krista, do you taunt each other over this? Is this like a regular banter thing, or is it built up over the last week or so?
It's built up over the last 9 years. How long have we been together?
9 years.
But this year specifically, since the Oilers had such a bad start, I still bet him that the Oilers would finish ahead of the Canucks, and they were like just shy. But he couldn't believe that I would bet that.
Yeah. I'm shocked. I mean, just from a relationship point, because, you know, sometimes friends fall out over cheering for rival sports teams. But it sounds like you guys have made it work, even though clearly this is part of your, I mean, you've made this these very different allegiances work just within your marriage, despite the fact that, I mean, this will put it to the test a little bit, Derek, I have to say.
Yeah, you know what? We've built furniture together. We've traveled together. We've gone on long, winding road trips together. IKEA has been a challenge, but this is definitely going to be our greatest challenge through our almost decade together. I mean, the last time the Canucks and the Oilers faced off was 1992 in the postseason. Yeah. Kristen was 5 years old when that happened. I'm old enough to remember it.
But just. So here's a trick question for you, Kristen. The most annoying thing Derek does during a hockey game when his team is winning, what is it?
Oh, just telling me to look at the score, or you know, Canucks fans, they get very cocky when they're up.
Don't indeed. And Derek, likewise.
No, not telling me what the score is. Probably spouting off something about McDavid. there's a lot to go off of there, because there's so many annoying things that Oilers fans do, and she does them all. She does them very well, though. I'll give her that.
The two of you really have to stream this tomorrow night. I mean, I'm sure people would happily watch the two of you watch the game. I'm serious. Do you have any? I was reading something funny the other day. Speaking of you going to Edmonton, Krista, I was reading someone saying that it was actually less expensive to fly to Edmonton and get tickets for game 3 and 4 than it was to go to see game 1 in Vancouver. Do you have any plans of maybe going to the game? I mean, it would be the two of you in game 7 wearing your opposite jerseys sitting beside each other would be a Jumbotron moment made in heaven.
Yeah, that's what I would love. We'll see when I'm in Edmonton. The Edmonton tickets are like a 2-for-1 compared to the Vancouver ones, so I'm going to look. But ideally, if that game 7 comes back to Vancouver, and I'll be back here by then, so that would be like a peak relationship moment, I think.
Derek, do you agree?
You know what? If they made it to game 7, I think that would definitely be I would have to agree with my lovely wife. That would be a peak moment for our time together. I would just have to make sure that I got a head start out the door after we, you know, knock them out.
And so when this is said and done, and one team's going to win and move on to the semifinals, right? The one team's going to be in the Final 4, essentially. Will you cheer for the other person's team after this round? Kristen?
I will. I've got to go with Canadian team after my own team.
All right. Derek?
I'm going to have to say yes, because, well,
that's the right answer.
It has to be Canadian team. It has to be. Like,
it is.
Enough.
Yeah, I mean, I was in Montreal. I was in Montreal when they won the Cup in 93, and if someone had said it'll be, you know, 30 years plus before you win another one, I would have told you there's absolutely no way. Derek and Kristen, I wish you the absolute best of luck. May the best team win. I'll just leave it at that. Thanks so much for thanks so much for your time, both of you, tonight. It was great to talk to you.
Thanks for having us.
Go Oilers.
Derek,
go, go.
There you go. There you go. Lidwood Barkley spent years working at newspapers, including the Toronto Star, while pursuing writing, even producing a humor column for the paper for a while. There were a few false starts before he surged to prominence when he was in his early 50s with a massive bestseller called No Time for Goodbye in 2007. It sold more than 1 million copies worldwide. It was really popular in the US. It was really popular in Britain, obviously here at home as well. And suddenly his career took off, right? And it's a beautiful story because he really was, had spent many years working hard to try and find that voice, to try and find the right formula to be a success, to be a, to write great thrillers, which he now does. The book, No Time for Goodbye, by the way, is all about a teenager named Cynthia Archer who wakes up one day with a hangover and suddenly realizes that she's had a confrontation with her mom and dad. And when she leaves her bedroom, her house is empty. There's no sign of her parents, her younger brother. And all of a sudden, without any explanation, her family has simply disappeared. Here's a snippet of the book trailer for that novel.
One night, your entire family disappears. Do you think they were murdered?
I don't know.
Do you think that they just decided to leave and not take you with them?
I don't know. I don't know which would be worse. If they were all dead or they didn't want me.
What I'm wondering is how your family can disappear one night, yet nothing happened to you.
After all these years, why won't people believe me?
Oh, it's a good one, that one, by the way, if you get a chance. I mean, you have to go back to the beginning of his career to read that one, but that's a really good book. After taking a sabbatical from the Star to promote that book, he realized he wouldn't have to return. So, at least not for long. He wrote his final column in 2008. And then what followed has been more than 20 novels, including 2008's Too Close to Home, which he won the Arthur Ellis Award for Best Novel, and 2022's Take Your Breath Away, which was shortlisted for the prestigious CWA Ian Fleming Silver Dagger Award. We last spoke with Linwood Barclay back in 2022 when he released this really cool futuristic thriller called Look Both Ways, which imagines self-driving cars wreaking havoc on a small island because they've been sabotaged during a pilot project. In other words, he often finds inspirations for his plots in current events. And that's no different from his latest novel, which is out today, called I Will Ruin You. It's the story of a high school teacher named Richard Boyle, who has no sooner thwarted an attack on his high school by a former student than he finds himself in the spotlight for all the wrong reasons. No deed goes unpunished. No good deed goes unpunished, as I said off the top. Along the way, it tackles the fentanyl epidemic, censorship in schools around books, and the way in which information can be weaponized and turned against someone, leaving them with few, if any, good options. And it's my pleasure to welcome back Linwood Barclay to talk about his new book, I'll Ruin You. Linwood, thank you. Welcome back.
Hey, it's a pleasure, Ben. Nice to be with you.
I was counting. I don't know if my number was right, but I think this is 27. I think.
Oh, man. I don't know. Well, it depends. I guess it depends to some degree on what you count. Right. I mean, if you count novels, I think it's 23 or 4.
Okay, gotcha.
I did a memoir. I did a couple of thrillers for young readers. And then I did one book making fun of Mike Harris and another making fun of Doug Ford. You know, those books had footnotes, by the way. So if you count all of them, but I count the novels, for grown-ups.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this one is called I Will Ruin You. It has, in some ways, it's a kind of a familiar plot devices, but there's a lot going on in it. I was interested in the fact that that you made a teacher the center of it. And at the end, in your thank yous, you acknowledge the work that teachers do. And I thought, well, there must have been, you know, one chooses one's lead characters carefully, don't they?
Yeah, well, you know, a long time ago, the biggest book hit I ever had was a book called No Time for Goodbye. It was around 2008, and that was a teacher as well.
Right.
But I hadn't had teachers in a while, and so I came back to them, and of course, given the nature of the story, it kind of demanded that there'd be a teacher. But I did kind of include at the end this thank you to teachers, who I think are a thankless profession, I think. There's so many demands made on them. People judge every single thing they do. They're, you know, along with librarians, they're under attack for what they have kids read. and all for such, you know, such this magnificent salary that they get. I mean, why would you want to take that kind of abuse for sort of a pretty average salary? I mean, some pay okay, but it's still to keep, and I think in many ways it's a, they're underappreciated and undervalued. And you know, I mean, my wife was a teacher, and she took a bit of an early retirement when I book started to do well and I was doing a lot of traveling. But I saw firsthand with her and her, you know, associates how hard a job it was. And it was really tough. And sometimes I'd go dropping on her class. It was a kindergarten class, actually, which, and I was like, I could be there for like 5 minutes and I wanted to shoot myself. I just thought, I can't take this. I have to get out of here. And so I could see how hard they worked. And so I think people don't have an appreciation for what they go through.
I know that oftentimes, I mean, the last time we spoke, it was about Look Both Ways, which was a very prescient novel about the potential dangers of self-driving cars. And this one also feels like there's a lot coming out of it that is very current. I mean, it deals in some senses with the fentanyl, with the opioid crisis and fentanyl. And it is the 20th anniversary of the horrific attack on Columbine, which I think for anyone who remembers it will always be very vivid. And so this book sort of combines some of those societal things that are going on, school violence, drugs, and so on. Is that often how you sort of look for inspiration? What's up?
I often do. I often look at things that are just going on in the world that really annoy me or whatever. I mean, a couple of my books I think have kind of dealt with in an offhand way the sad state of newspapers and journalism. And I think it was in, which book was it? I think it was Elevator Pitch. I mean, I took a look at this left, right, ridiculous divide, you know, and the lack of interest in such things as facts and all those kind of things drive me crazy. And so they often find, you know, I think there has been in recent years a kind of celebration of ignorance. And that drives me crazier than just about anything. And there's a little bit of that in this book too, because this book also touches on this whole business of book banning. And my main character has introduced into his own curriculum a book that he thinks the kids would find interesting, which happens to be The Road by Cormac McCarthy. And there's some pretty grim stuff in that book, including, cannibalism. And of course, one of the parents who get upset about this is, so now the schools are encouraging cannibalism. Well, not really. You know, no more than Little Red Riding Hood was encouraging that wolves eat children or whatever. You know, like it's just, but it's that kind of thing that drives me crazy. So that is one of sort of the subplots in this book.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. I found that to be a really interesting subplot because you carry it through the whole book. It comes up again. It's used against him by someone who's upset at him. We won't get into all the detail. I don't want to give away the plot. But this idea that he chooses, there's a part near the beginning where the teacher, in this case, Richard Boyle, says that the current curriculum doesn't offer up books that'll interest his students. And therefore he goes outside the curriculum to find things that he thinks will. And he answers their questions about them. It's interesting when you mentioned Carl Hiaasen in there, who I think is a great author. I love The Road. I mean, it's a tough read, but it's a great book. And just the care that he takes to try to present these difficult topics to a group of kids who are of age to basically understand them, right? And it's an interesting way that you approach it. I mean, you've explained it, but it is an interesting way to put that, to make that a subplot of this book when you could have kind of, I think you could have probably sidestepped it if you'd wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to teach kids books that will in no way upset anyone, then you could teach them like the history of pablum. good works of literature challenge and provoke promote discussion and so forth. And that's a good thing. And I think there's a lot of people who just don't want anything to be taught that raises any kind of questions about anything at all. And how does that prepare kids to go out into the world? Not really, I don't think.
And the way it's weaponized, too. I mean, you bring that up, too. This other teacher has a beef, and therefore he uses this because he knows it works.
Yeah. So that's, like, I mean, I did throw a number of things in this book, but I think it still has a kind of nice straight line through.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this teacher, Richard Boyle, he... manages to avert what could have been a much larger catastrophe when a kid comes to the school with intent to do tremendous harm. And, you know, in a world where no good act goes unpunished, the notoriety that he receives for this attracts the attention of a former student of the school who alleges that there was something very bad that he did, and now he's trapped into a whole blackmail scheme. So, which is kind of the main story, but
yes,
a lot of other things that start bumping up against it.
And what was really, I mean, again, I don't want listeners to think there's subplots, but the whole thing barrels on like a freight train. It really does. But it struck me as being a nice throwback to sort of your quintessential, almost Hitchcock story, right? Where you sort of mm-hmm. have this character who does right and then finds himself paying a huge price for it, having to make some very, very difficult and potentially, you know, career threatening, marriage threatening decisions.
Yeah. And also like in a kind of Hitchcock way, I think, is that you get your main character in a bad situation and then you just keep making it worse.
Right.
You just keep turning that screw a little tighter and you think, okay, now we can't do anything else to him now. And then we do. And so that's always fun. I mean, you get well into the book and you think, well, I've really made this guy's life hell. What can I do to make it worse? And so I think that when you finally get to an end of a book like this, and he gets through all these things, there's this kind of sense, I think, of relief or justice or something. You know?
Yeah, I love it as a reader when you essentially find yourself out loud telling the character not to do it.
You can, and you do that, but the thing is that you can think that, but it also has to make sense that he's going to do the thing that you don't want him to do.
Yes,
because it's like these pictures where it's like that girl really shouldn't go into the basement. And something bad's going to happen, but yet she goes anyway. And you just sort of go, oh, how could she be so dumb? But so what you need is you have to have something that's at stake, that something is important enough that you will accept that they will do this thing that's risky. You know?
Yeah, you have to kind of put yourself in their shoes and think there were no good options, would you take what feels like the bad one too, even though you have the benefit of being both an outsider and hindsight?
Yeah, it's the least. What's the least worst thing that maybe he can do next? You know, that but you won't sort of just go, oh, come on. I mean, there's always in a thriller when you have sort of an everyman or an everywoman caught in a bad situation, it's always like, well, just call the cops. That's what we would do, right? You just call the cops. You just call 911. And there has to be a compelling reason not to do that. You know?
Yeah. And then, of course, even the small lies snowball, right? And then it becomes the whole thing takes on a life of its own, which feels, and then you spend the whole time hoping the character can put it back together.
Yeah, I know. I had a lot of fun writing this one.
Yeah, yeah, you can tell.
It was funny. I did one sort of false start on it. I did about 80 pages on it, and I realized I was going the wrong way, and I started over. But all in all, it finally came together.
Ludwig Barclay, bestselling author. His latest is called I Will Ruin You. The name kind of is enticing in of itself. Ludwig, when you sit down, I mean, it's interesting, the whole process of writing these books, because you do write a lot. I mean, you have one out each year, and they often have interesting things to say about what's going on in the world right now. How would you like readers to walk away with them? Because thrillers can be, what I love about thrillers is they can be anything you want them to be. They can be like a beach read, or you can actually dive into them or think about what else is going on in the subplot and so on.
I was at a writer's conference a few years ago, and there was a writer, I think his name was Thomas Cook, lovely guy. And he was, we were talking about crime fiction and so forth. And he said to someone who was interested about some kind of an issue and wanted to be able to write a novel about this issue. And his advice was, okay, take that issue and put a murder in it. Now you can write about anything you want, but you've got this mystery that has to be solved along the way. And that can be that's your kind of engine. That's what can take you through this story. And you can attach to it along the way all these things that you want to get off your chest that you want to write about.
There's some interesting kids in this book too. And I was wondering if you got inspiration, where you got the inspiration for it. Because your children always strike me as being well thought out.
You know, I don't know. I like to think that the kids in the books are generally pretty smart. Mm-hmm. Not these sort of smart alecky kids from sitcoms, you know, that are just annoying, but they're often as smart or smarter than their parents. They can see things that they don't. And I mean, our kids, I mean, my son just turned 40. So it's been a while since I've been able to observe them in the habitat
right.
in the home. But, you know, I had the good fortune when I was a columnist for the Toronto Star and I worked for home from home. And I was home, you know, when the kids left for school, and I was home when they got home and when they got back from school, which is really annoying for kids in high school who want to come home and do things they're not supposed to. So they'd have to go somewhere else. But I mean, I just like to watch them, you know, and observe. And I hope that just kind of comes through naturally when I'm writing about kids. I try to see from their perspective. You know, I try to imagine when I write a kid's dialogue, I'm trying to think, how would they perceive this and write it in that way?
Yeah, because often they are the most perceptive, right? I mean, in some senses, they're the most perceptive.
Yeah, I think so. And also, they're often the ones who are in the most jeopardy. Like if everything goes to shambles in the household, I mean, who's going to get hurt the most by it? So they're the ones who are often the most fragile, the most in the most sort of perilous situation.
When you walk away from this, what I walked away with it from was that there is a lot here about sort of the state of play, 2024, you know, anger, you know, alienation, talking about things, blame. I mean, it feels like we're living in a bit of a, and you mentioned it earlier, it feels like we're living in fraught times. And there is quite a few of those themes that pop up in this book that, I mean, it's not the central thrust of Thriller, but it is, they're all there. Like all these things that are happening around us about sort of the Jacques kind of thing is all there too, you know, about social media and being in the spotlight and misperceptions about things and drugs and all sort of, it's very of 2024, I found.
Yeah, and it's also we're in this kind of world where it's never my fault, it's somebody else's.
Right.
And, you know, this particular teacher in the story who thwarts what could have been a disastrous situation with this dangerous student. And so what happens? He's going to be sued by that student's parents because he didn't do a better job of diffusing the situation. And even better, you know, and look, it's not their fault that their kid wanted to come to the school and do all these horrible things. It's the school's fault that they didn't stop him in a more efficient way. You know, and you see that all the time. Like, nothing is my fault. It's always
the blame.
And it's not even, I think, that I'm necessarily making a conscious decision to weave that into a book. It's just, I just look at the world and all things drive me nuts. And it just happens. It just gets into the book.
Yeah. And it's interesting that not long into the book, his heroism of the first few pages is almost incidental. I mean, it unleashes the whole story, but it's almost incidental. And you think, wait a second, he just saved a school from disaster. And yet within a few pages, he's basically fighting off, you know, he's fighting off a lot more than that.
Well, like I said before, you said it's like, maybe the title should have been No Good Deed Goes Unpunished.
Yeah. Well, Linwood, as always, it's a fascinating read. I highly recommend it. And thanks for your time.
It's been a pleasure, Ben. Thanks for having me.